In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. From enslaved people in the Renaissance era to Roman emperors and medieval saints, African people have long played a role in European history. The presence of Africans in Europe is something that Professor Olivetta Telly traces in her book, African Europeans, An Untold Story. In a conversation recorded as part of our virtual lecture series, she told our content director, Dave Musgrove, more.
Very, very excited and pleased to be able to welcome our speaker. She's extremely busy and has a lot going on her plate, so really great that we've been able to get her. It's Professor Olivetta Telly, who is author of African Europeans, An Untold History, and she's also Professor of the History of Slavery and Memory of Enslavement at the University of Bristol, and indeed a Vice President of the Royal Historical Society. So someone right up there in the upper echelons of the history community. So Olivetta, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. So your latest book, your new book, African Europeans. In the intro to the book, you explain that quite a few books have been written, quite a lot of research has been carried out on specific Black individuals in Europe, often in association with the abolition of slavery or the Black presence in certain defined geographical areas. But you're taking a much broader look, right? You're trying to consider the place of Africans right across Europe over two millennia. So just drop us in. What are you trying to do with the book, and what persistent myths are you attempting to debunk?
Well, actually, I'm fascinated by long histories, and I like the idea that, you know, very specific, focused history can tell you about events and the excitement around the event. But what I like to know is what preceded that, what led to that, and sometimes you don't have that. So I really wanted to go beyond the Black presence in certain settings and look at the global kind of presence, global, mostly European, African presence in European settings. And I also wanted to look at the idea that we can't have multiple identities. Well, already in the third century, some people did. And I wanted to look at that and go into in that and interrogate the fact that when we talk about African presence or Black presence in Europe, it's always very contentious. It's a history of pain, rarely a history of collaborations. I wanted to inject some nuances, really.
And one of the things you talk about is you're challenging the way that researchers have dealt with certain Black African Europeans as kind of exceptional, sort of focusing on individuals, I guess. So tell us what you're trying to do there.
That was interesting as well, because I did that. I focused on certain individuals. But the idea was to show that by focusing on individuals, you do have a glimpse of what their lives were like. And also because these are the very few accounts that we have in terms of archival material. But by putting them up there on the pedestal, there's this narrative about them being so exceptional that they cannot represent the whole community of Africans. Therefore, they're completely different. They're barely even not Africans. And in turns, you know, it's because they were so close to European narratives and European journeys and European intellectuals. That's why they became exceptional. And I really wanted to fight against that as well. You know, exceptionalizing people is a double-edged sword.
So you're trying to place those individuals in the wider communities that they existed in. And you, you will forgive me if we do mention a couple of individuals as we go through, though, I hope. So you've already talked a little bit about the term African-European, and kind of you say in the book that it's a provocation for those who deny this idea of multiple identities, as you just said. But the subject and geographical spread of your book is broad. It's a couple of millennia. It's an entire continent. How possible is it to generalize about African-Europeans as a group?
It's virtually impossible. So actually, the provocation is also in the terms of the use of African Europeans as a reference or echo to the term African Americans. And I wanted to play with that as well. African Americans, meaning people who came from the African continent, or at least their ancestors, came from different places in the African continent. And yet they call themselves nowadays African Americans. Therefore, there's a recognition of that past with multiple kind of geographical origins. And it's the same for African Europeans. And I thought, why not as well do that? It's very hard indeed to generalize. And that's not at all what I'm trying to do here. Again, it's a provocation. You pick and choose. And yet all these people were indeed, you know, defined as Africans, but they also were Europeans.
Okay, I'm going to attempt to sort of go through the chronology that you do. We're probably not going to have enough time, so we'll have to skip over some bits. But let's go back to the start of your book and the classical period, the Roman period, where you kick off. What was the Roman imperial attitude to Africa and Africans? I think I read in the book that you said there wasn't necessarily a clear divide between Europe and Africa amongst in the Roman mind.
No, it wasn't as defined as we see it nowadays, and simply because the Roman Empire was about conquest and territories and acquiring more and more territories. So what is defined as Africa is yet another place to conquer and to reign and to dominate. And the subject, the colonial subject in those spaces, had the possibility to go to Rome or to go to European settings and capitals and to try and make a name for themselves if they wanted to, and if they had the connections needed for that. And that's why I took Septimius Severus, for example. So there's a class element that is much more important there than the story of race. Actually, and then I show through other examples, Fronto and many others, that there's also this idea of claiming one's spaces and one places of birth by claiming, by being proud and presenting themselves as Africans, although they belong to the Roman Empire, they're Roman subjects, actually. So it was interesting for me to play with these different, the way they use these identities to get ahead and to just, you know, further their career in some places.
Tell us more about Septimus Severus. You mentioned him there. Who was he and what was his place in the story?
He's an interesting character. Well, he was an interesting character because quite often when we talk about the Roman Empire, we rarely make the connections with North Africa. And he was somebody who was born in North Africa in a very wealthy family. So he had the connections needed. He was very ambitious, very intelligent, hardworking, sounds like a good person, but he wasn't at all. He was incredibly ruthless in his ambition. So he managed to kind of seize the moment, come to Rome at the time when Rome has got rid of its emperor, seize the power, make connections with politicians, the Senate, and present himself as the new savior of Rome. He goes on a conquest spree like most of the Roman emperors did, and ends up in Britannia. And long story short, he dies in York, but before that he's there to subjugate the populations and to impose his reign. So you have somebody who's not particularly nice. But what was interesting for me to look at as well is kind of his story as a father, as a failed father, really. Because he was so ambitious and consumed by his career that he allowed his two sons to completely do whatever they wanted, The butchery was well known, and the two brothers were competing against each other. The two brothers were ruthless criminals in nowadays, probably not necessarily up to the challenge of reigning, but what was interesting is that the father constantly trying to save them, providing a bride for Caracalla, one of them. And the bride was the daughter of Septimius' best friend, who also came from North Africa. And in the end, they were so horrible, all of them, that even the best friend decided that he needed to kill the emperor. Of course, it was a failed attempt, and the friend ended up being killed. It's really a story of stuff that makes movies. It's horrible. It's full of intrigues. And I wanted to show that those African Europeans are not simply intellectuals who were flying around across, sailing across Europe and making friends. Some of them were actually horrible, and they are part of European history because they were Europeans. Septimius bust is at the British Museum. He's very much a European and African.
Yeah. So where, do we know where he was actually born? Is there any
Leptis
somewhere in
Magna,
North Africa?
Yes, North Africa, which is nowadays Libya.
Okay, brilliant. Right, let's leap on a bit, because like I said, I want to cover a fair bit of ground. So I want to move us into the Middle Ages, if that's okay. But there is a link from your book to help us do that, and that's St. Maurus, actually tell us about St. Maurus. So he's a third century figure who becomes obviously important in Rome, who then becomes important in the Middle Ages. So chart that journey for us.
Well, St. Maurus is another one. He's said to have been born actually in nowadays Egypt. So North African again, and he defied the power by refusing to bow to the emperor. I'm going quite quickly about his story here, the beginning at least. He was executed, but what is interesting for me was the legend of St. Maurus, how it was transformed. So we move from this North African defying Rome, who died as a martyr and then becomes a key figure in European history as somebody who was brave, as somebody who was religious, as somebody that we find in 13th century, Germany, Brandenburg, Germany, and who completely transformed the way we looked at religion, because he's a black saint and he's presented as such and he's honored as such. So you have this black figure in European landscape, really, that is quite staggering. But at the same time, people are accepting that there's a link between conquest, religion, and at the same time, he's part of kind of European identity. So it's not that his color transcends everything. It's just his color is part of European story. And again, it's accepted in the Middle Ages. And I find it incredibly interesting.
Hmm. And so for there to be depictions of him as a black African suggests that there must have been the people who were carving him must have had models. They must have known what black Africans look like, which suggests further that there must have been some sort of presence of black Africans in Europe at this time. What do we know about that, the level and nature of that presence?
There was a presence. I mean, by the time the legend in 13th century, by the time we talk about that black presence, you've had a few Africans who have traveled to Europe through possibly the slave trade, the Venetian slave trade, but also because some of them, as I said, were part of the Roman Empire. So it's not an unknown presence at all. It's actually so much documented that you find them in certain stories, you find them in legends, for example. But the key discourse or debate is not so much about blackness, it's about religion. What poses problem was, are they Muslims or not? Because if they're Muslims, that's when the antagonism really kicks off. And therefore, that's where they transform, they're depicted as different as such. So again, but I have to say there's a caveat to this, because color by that time also has started to be associated with black color, associated with the color of evil because of the Bible and all sort of things. So it's not as clear cut as we would like it to be.
Yeah, the attitude in the Middle Ages of colour in many ways, not just blackness, but all colours had quite interesting significance, didn't they? So thinking about when colour does, so when does race and skin colour start to become an issue in Europe then?
I would probably say the 12th century, 11th, 12th century. You have a group of doctors who were very much into examining the women's body and black women's body. So there's something that started to permeate that is related to, first of all, Arab medical doctors really examining all sort of bodies. And then you have Europeans examining a women's body and trying to see differences between the black woman and the white woman in child rearing, breastfeeding and all sort of and their sexual organs. So there's a discourse there that starts to emerge that is about kind of differences, alleged differences, a disturbing discourse because it's not based on it's not scientific, and yet it's done by doctors. It's an alleged discovery about physical differences and attitude associated to attitude. For example, black women are said to be prone to intercourses, but good with childcare. You know, all sort of or things that 21st century people are not completely are familiar with, you know, and they start in the 11th century, 12th century, and it's quite interesting. But it's not based on anything tangible, but, you know, because they are respected at the time, this is seen as proof of any significant differences. But it's not necessarily in terms of hierarchy, it's just differences. And then the hierarchy kicks in with the Crusades and, as I said, religion, the association of religion and blackness becomes something crucial for European identity, actually.
And does this take us into the work of Geraldine Heng, who you talk about, reference quite a lot in the book? She's a scholar who's written a very interesting book recently. She basically says that the question of race was fundamental to the formation of European identity. So is that tying into what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And I'm fascinated by her work simply because it's the kind of questions I've been interested in for a very long time, but she looks at the medieval Europe and the idea that identity and religion were something, but also the fact that the differences, racialization, is not necessarily what we think of it as today. Racialization also started with not just religion, but with geographical location. What she means by that is that the Irish population were racialized and deemed inferior. She looked at the way they were represented. And I'm laughing because I'm thinking about the map. I've forgotten the name of the map, but there's a map that she talks about. And that map is supposed to represent the world. And you have Europe with fields, cathedrals, and all sort of very neat architectural, neat as far as we can say, architectural representation. The rest of the world is just made of beasts, half humans and all sort of creatures. And this is how they saw the rest of the world. If you're not European, you're probably abnormal. So it's already establishing a hierarchy and a racialization. And within that space, you have very close to nowadays Britain, Irish population deemed unworthy, bestial, and therefore not quite human. So racialization has many degrees and many layers, really.
Would that be the Hereford Map of Monday, I think?
Yes, that's the one.
Yeah. An amazing thing to look at, but you're right, also quite surprising in what it shows in many respects. Reading the reviews of you, but one of your reviewers has said that for most of European history, religious difference was a far more important vector of prejudice than skin colour or geographic origin. So do you agree with that comment in one of the reviews?
Yes. And again, I would put a caveat to that because of the strength and the role of the Bible. You know, the Bible was interpreted in so many different ways, and one of the many interpretation was about this idea of blackness equated to evil equating to bad, and therefore black means evil. And the way to redeem oneself was to turn white. And I talk about a few stories about that in the book. How do you redeem yourself by turning white? Well, through stories and legends, you know, the Black Madonnas and the idea of Black Madonnas who were representations of the Virgin Mary, really, who were apparently have been sculpted black, were turning white. But it might not be because of the passing of time, but because this is supposed to represent how through devotion and purity, one is made to turn white little by little over time. So there are so many interpretations of blackness already that are actually linked to religion, but also to color.
So does that mean that the medieval church was driving an agenda of negativity towards black as a color and black as a skin color then?
Black as a color of equated to evil, but it's not just blackness. It's also the Jewish population. As I said, it's also Ireland. So it's not just the color. It's to do with difference. The other was deemed, if the other was not Christian, well, therefore the other were bound to be evil.
Okay. So moving on towards the end of the medieval period, you've already talked a little bit about the slave trade. And I guess that's where, towards the end of the medieval period, that's where it starts to become more significant. And your book takes us to Portugal, where we start to see Portuguese merchants trying to get actively involved in the slave trade in the, where are we, sort of end of the 15th century? Is that about right? Yeah. So, one of the key moments there is the fall of Constantinople in that period, 1485, is it? Which changes sort of the axis of European slavery, where slaves are enslaved, people are being brought from. So is that kind of a very important moment?
Yes, it's a crucial moment because you also have enslaved people from the Arab world, who were then became accessible, if you would, to Europeans. And at the same time, you have from the south, southern part of Europe, you have the Venetian merchants who were losing slowly their grips as well. And the Portuguese fighting to have access to the slave trade or to the Arab trade and to the kind of sub-Saharan slave trade as well. So everything is opening up more or less at the same time. And Portugal is one of the first country to really take hold of that, and it's just trying to use that advantage to dominate the rest of Europe, because again the context is very important. The context is European kingdoms fighting over who's going to have access to the throne with the support of the Pope. So the person who have access to those markets is the person who will be able to have access to wealth and therefore dictate what the rest of the Europeans would do.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And if you're a black person and you're a free person, you have to walk with what they call the cartouche, which is a form of ID. And a form of ID means that, you're not completely free. You have to justify why you're walking as a free black person in Paris or in Nantes at the time.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Portugal's interesting, and you talk about that in your book, and Iberia generally, as talking about Europe here, and Iberia is obviously a large part of Europe, but it's got a very different experience to a lot of the rest of Europe in the sense that it was for quite a long time part of a North African empire. So does that mean that there's very different attitudes and stories going on there?
Yes, it's a story of defeat being transformed into victory. Portugal, like many countries, in fact, France, we always say Poitiers until Poitiers. You know, the Arabs went all the way up and stopped in Poitiers, which is kind of middle of France nowadays. So they went very far. So managing to get rid of North Africans was an important step. And then there was a cleaning process in terms of identities that took place, where anything to do with the Arabs, as far as culture was concerned, stayed. But as far as the connection with skin color, with identity, closer identity, visible identity, was kind of removed from the culture. So Portugal becomes, between brackets, white, trying to forget that, you know, there was still a very stronghold of Arab culture that stayed for centuries. And it's quite an interesting story as well, because Portugal wants to claim that space within the European environment and will manage to do that, actually, till the end of the 19th century, as far as the slave trade is concerned, actually.
Staying in Iberia, can you tell us about Juan Latino, who's an interesting figure in your book?
Yes, he's a very very interesting character. So he was born. We don't know if he was born in Granada, but or North Africa, but he grew up in Granada as an enslaved person, and managed to get the support of the elite. Of the crown, the court. And he was somebody who was intellectually stimulating, absolutely fascinating, very, very clever, extremely intelligent and extremely curious, and somebody who was devouring anything to do with literature, history. So rapidly he rose amongst the rank, he becomes an academic, he's supported by the crown again, and he's going to write a series of kind of pamphlets and plays and philosophical essays that are incredibly important, because he was somebody who was supporting the Christian and the Catholics. But at the same time, Granada at the time was a place where, what I mentioned earlier, they were trying to get rid of the Arab influence, and therefore there was a population called the Moriscos who were Arabs who had been forced to convert to Catholicism, who were oppressed. You also have a Jewish population that was oppressed in Granada. And Juan Latino is going to manage to do something extraordinary, is to actually denounce that without antagonizing those who are in power. So he wrote something that is incredible. He talks about the Battle of Lepanto, and it's a battle that, you know, that opposed the Arabs to the crown. And what he does is he's trying to show both sides and the pain that war causes for all. Instead of just writing something that is, you know, that is celebrating his sponsors, if you would, he's actually saying, look, it's terrible. What's happening is completely destroying Granada. And you need to look at this as the death of certain cultures. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And he was extraordinary.
Yeah, no, he's definitely worth finding out more about. And you have a fascinating chapter in the book all about him. So sort of staying in this sort of space, I'm just going to take a quote from the book. By the 16th century, Southern Europe was characterized by a sizable black population. Some of them, such as the first Duke of Florence, Alessandro de' Medici, reached prominence, while others lived their lives in subjugation. So how big a population are we talking here across Southern Europe, do you imagine?
I can't remember the figures, because actually there were studies done by that, because the population was mostly, the population, is it 20,000? It was in Spain. It was a population that was because they were enslaved people, they were recorded as such. So we know that we know the numbers. What is interesting is that Medici doesn't really feature in that category, because the more you have people from sub-Sahara Africa or North Africa who are subjugated, the more clearer it becomes that mentalities have changed. Those populations are deemed, deemed not unworthy. They're very useful. Are considered to be useful, but they're deemed inferior. So you have a number of plays written about them, caricaturing them. But in my book, what I wanted to show is that within those spaces, you also have some form of agency. Because in certain instances that I use, and I use the work of Erin Rowe for that, is that some enslaved people, when their masters decided to sell them, they had a say in the sell. And they had a say in the sell how? By the way they behaved in the first few encounters, and by the way they behave in the kind of probation period that enslaved people had were given. In other words, if you're selling an enslaved person, for example, for 5 days, 10 days, they're going to spend the time with the person who bought them. And during those 5-10 days, the enslaved person could completely misbehave. And then you lose your cell. So there's some form of resistance, some form of agency. And you have other example where these people actually had the ear of their master and were able to influence certain things, spread gossip, destroy reputations, and so on and so forth.
So not just passive objects of slavery, but actively engaged in society, albeit in a constrained fashion.
Yes. I also talked about, Black fraternities. Black fraternities, 15th century, incredibly important and incredibly powerful. Anyway, there are many instances of agency in there that I wanted to talk about.
Moving to Northern Europe, by the 17th century, the Dutch Republic, France and England are more actively involved in the slave trade as well. So I guess it's at that point that attitudes towards Black Africans start to change across the continents. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes. By that time, they have dramatically changed. Economic domination and economic success have made Europeans quite arrogant in terms of their consideration to whatever is seen as the other. There are justification. Initially, it was supposed to be a trade based on human beings, but nonetheless a trade. But to justify that trade, there are also the theories about the inferiority of the commodity. Because it's very hard to have a commodity that speaks, that reflects, and that challenges. And therefore, there's a narrative constructed about this alleged inferiority and faults. But it doesn't quite go along the way with what is happening on the ground. In other words, they constantly challenge. There's these areas I talked to you about of collaborations are really difficult to reconcile. And therefore, to be able to reconcile them and to justify the fact that these populations are still subjugated, a series of laws were passed throughout Europe, preventing those from the colonies in the Caribbean from coming to Europe, which put those the masters who were in the Caribbean at odd, because they usually traveled and wanted to travel with their enslaved people. So you have a kind of a fight, a battle of the wills, but also legal battles between owners and those and merchants who are in European capitals and through the law, really.
And that's all. That one of the interesting themes in your discussion here is the sort of the ambiguous legal status of Black Africans in Europe at the time. You've got some people who are enslaved and some people who are not, and how that was defined and delimited. It was hard for white Europeans to come to terms with. I think is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. Again, I find spaces of agency and resistance within those environments. The law is saying that if you're an enslaved person, well, it depends when it says that, but in some places, if you're an enslaved person, when you arrive in European capitals, you become automatically free because slavery normally, allegedly, does not exist. You become a servant, but you're enslaved, but you become a servant. But if you're a servant, you are therefore allowed normally to just walk away. But that's not quite it. You have people resisting this idea that they could just lose their enslaved people when they reach European capitals. And we have a few instances of people walking away. But to ensure that they don't walk away, France, for example, in 1776, adopts set up La Police des Noirs, which is the police for Black people. And if you're a Black person and you're a free person, you have to walk with what they call the cartouche, which is a form of ID. And a form of ID means that, well, you're not completely free. You have to justify why you're walking as a free Black person in Paris or in Nantes at the time. And really prove that you are indeed free, which was not always easy to demonstrate as well. So and within that space again, you have cases, legal cases, where people manage to actually challenge their former master and the law by saying that, well, you shouldn't even, it's the stop and search of today, if you would. You shouldn't even be doing that because it's targeting a population. And I find it absolutely fascinating.
I think you've got a line in your book where you said that law effectively criminalised being Black in France. Is that
yes.
Right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Crazy. Let's move on to abolition of the slave trade and slavery. Again, agency, that's one of the big themes in abolition studies at the moment, is it's not, you know, we shouldn't understand this in the terms of Wilberforce and people like that. There's agency of people who were enslaved very much in that process. That's an important point to take on board, isn't it?
Yes, a very important point. So while abolition talks are taking place in Europe, you also have a huge number of rebellions in the Caribbean that are forcing owners to kind of rethink. And they want the support of the mainland England, for example, mainland Britain. And they can't have that support completely because of the debate. And within those spaces, meaning in England, you also have Black presence and Black organization and Black people, some called Sons of Africa, for example, who are working with white abolitionists. This is an incredible moment of collaboration, an incredible moment that I still think has been underestimated, because these people were holding secret meetings, private public meetings, and actually working together to come to solutions and to strategy that would work. Mainly outside Parliament, but within Parliament as well, as we know, through Wilberforce and many others.
So is that a research project that needs more investigation, if you feel it's being undercooked?
No. These are stories many of us have been teaching for many years. But, you know, there's a push to always talk about the great names, and Wilberforce was one of the many great names. But I think it's really important to show the nuances and how he could not have done what he did if he hadn't had the support of others outside that and the support of a Black population as well.
Okay, we're going to charge on again. I knew that, you know, this is an absolute ridiculous whistle-top story, but I'm going to take us to the 20th century and sort of the big fractures of the 20th century, the two world wars, obviously. What impact did those two world wars have on the place of African Europeans and their role and place in Europe?
To me, the two world war become something else. It's the first time that more people are seeing Black regiments. It's also an area of collaborations, of distrust, of course, but also of collaboration. And that completely defined the way European history is thought. And for many years now, many people have been working on presenting that history of collaborations. David Lusoga has done some work on this and many others. So it's completely shift our outlook on the Black or people of African descent and people of Asian descent. But I think that we got stuck into that period. For many people who are aware of this, they think that this is when migration started, and we know it wasn't. So again, we need to show that, you know, there were many of the populations were coming from empire, but many were already in Britain, and they joined the ranks and they fought with the allies.
Did attitudes change markedly as a result of that?
Yes and no. You have more Black babies and brown babies born after the the war, but attitudes in terms of racism are, you know, there's a rejection of those collaborations and those forms of collaboration. So there's a reckoning or recognition that this population exists and collaborated and helped, but there's a rejection that they should actually be considered fully part of European identity, and fully be considered European. So they change, but not necessarily in the way people were expecting. But things are different from the slave trade. So to a certain extent, you can say that it's better-ish.
Mm. Okay, so we've really charged for it, but it's highlighted one of the central tenets of your book in a very top-level way, which you might want to say a little bit more about, which is that Black history is European history. And we've come up with a few examples there to demonstrate that. But do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit more? Because I feel like you haven't had ample opportunity to stress that.
When you have encounters of populations, when you have difficult encounters, but also collaborations, when you have areas of complexity, you want to narrow it down. You want something that is simple and you just resume it and summarize it to European history. But yes, African history is European history and vice versa. Because in the book, I also talk about those Europeans who are actually the Mamluks, who are also Africans, who are also Muslims. I also talk about children born out of from the union of Europeans and Black mothers on the west coast of Africa. So it's Black Europeans is African history and vice versa.
That was Oliver Titelli speaking to Dave Musgrove as part of our virtual lecture series. Olivet's book, African Europeans, An Untold History, is on sale now, published by Hearst. If you're interested in attending one of our virtual lectures, we have some great talks coming up, including Eleanor Cleghorn, who will be speaking about the story of women and medicine on the 22nd of July. To find out more, go to historyextra.com/events. And listeners to this podcast can get 15% off tickets for that talk. Just use coupon code POD15 at the checkout. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us tomorrow for an episode on the Enlightenment.